Veronica, though she was no talker, was an admirable listener, for she had a quick and receptive mind. She considered and stored away for future reference the concepts of men and things that were being presented to her. For the first time she heard the doctrine of the immortality of the soul brought to its logical conclusion as Lucas talked glibly of past lives and their influence upon the present, treating these subjects with an easy familiarity which showed that they were part of the habitual content of his consciousness. To him, death was on a par with emigration, a serious undertaking for a poor man, but merely an interesting and exciting adventure for the man rich in knowledge. Premature death, however, he objected to strongly, not because he feared to die, but because of the time it took to train a new body for service. Veronica found herself brought face to face with a new set of values in life: the body, the world, held cheap and made to serve an end of which no hint had hitherto reached her. Indeed, Lucas did not even speak of the body, but of a body, and the world was regarded as a world of effects, with but little power to set up causes on its own account. What happened there was to Lucas an aftermath. The real struggle, the real event, had taken place upon a subtler plane. Veronica found the concept presented to her of great forces, governed by great laws, that operated behind the multiplex happenings of our haphazard existence. The aim of Lucas's life, she learned, was to discover the nature of these laws and so control their forces by balancing one against the other, that the power of his will, infinitesimal though it was by comparison, should be able to turn the scale. Now Veronica, though she neither talked nor reasoned, was not a fool. She soon perceived that, while Lucas talked much of the occult powers and the means of their attainment, he gave no hint as to the use he meant to make of them when once attained. She set herself to work, in her quiet little way, to find out what his ultimate aim might be, and she speedily discovered that he had not got one. He was playing with these powers as a child might play with a Meccano outfit, making little models that would hoist little weights, all designed upon the best engineering principles, but with never a thought of the greater purposes of life to which these principles might be applied. He studied the secret science for the delight of seeing the parts fit together and the mystery explained, and that great study, which is as much a religion as a science, was no more to him than a jigsaw puzzle. Lucas, absorbed in his narrative, never heeded his listener's attitude, till, pausing to search for a word, he found himself being surveyed with a quaint detachment and experienced an unpleasant feeling that in some way or other he had been making a fool of himself. Anxious to ascertain her attitude, he shot a question at her, for the first time that morning. "Well, what do you make of it all?" Veronica nodded her head sagely. "I think I see what you mean. There are things that cause other things to happen, and you want to know what they are so that you can get at them." "That's about it," said Lucas. "The control of causation, if you want to be precise. But what are you going to do with them when you have got hold of them?" "You can do anything you like with them. You could get anything you wanted. But one does not want such an awful lot. Come now, would not you like to have great resources at your disposal?" "I'd like a certain amount," said cautious Veronica, "but not too much. It would take such a lot of looking after. Besides, supposing you were balancing the forces and one of them slipped." "That is just exactly what has happened," muttered Lucas to himself, and fell silent for several minutes. Then he threw off his dark mood and spoke again. "What would you do with the resources of the world if you had them?" "I should get some frocks and books and pictures, and a dog. Oh yes, I should certainly get a dog. But that would not exhaust the resources of the world." "What would you do with the rest?" Veronica thought a moment. "I couldn't eat all the bread in the world, but I could see that the people who needed it got some, and that the greedy people did not gobble too much, which is what they do at present." "Why did you never think of doing that, Mr. Lucas?"
"Oh, I don't know. What has it got to do with me? But could you be happy, knowing that someone else was starving?"
"Good Lord, yes, that is their lookout. People have got to stand on their own feet. You would never get anywhere if you always waited for the stragglers. Civilization is built upon sacrifice, and if I have any choice in the matter, and I think that I have,
I propose to be one of the civilized, not one of the sacrificed. This was logic hard to answer, and Veronica did not attempt the task. She merely shook her head and said, "All the same, I don't believe you really like it, Mr. Lucas. You are always after something, and as soon as you get it you want the next thing. It is like the Mad Hatter's tea party, jam yesterday, and jam tomorrow, but never jam today. I like to enjoy myself as I go along." Lucas was enjoying himself vastly. Veronica was beginning to wake up, and it thoroughly amused him to reveal unexpected depths to her and listen to her shrewd little comments. There was more in her than he had expected. Her mind was not empty so much from lack of capacity as from lack of raw material. He imagined that he was doing a very great deal to Veronica. He little realized how much Veronica was doing to him. He, as well as she, was being presented with a new viewpoint. He might sweep aside her naive little assertions, but he could not ignore the fact that, quaintly though they might be expressed, they were singularly relevant, and that she had an uncanny knack of putting her finger on the weak spots in his position. Perhaps there was something to be said for her point of view after all. He himself had already experienced a keener enjoyment than he had ever known before in getting into sympathetic touch with this child. It was quite a different sensation to that of power. The manipulation of another being had its charms, of course, but they palled when the novelty wore off. But when, instead of manipulating and controlling, one could win another person to respond to one, why, then one was, in one's turn, stimulated, lifted onto a higher level. It opened up new vistas, new possibilities of experience, this action and reaction of two, as opposed to the solitary working of the one. But to achieve this interaction, one had to win the other to a willing cooperation. He knew exactly how he meant to work upon her mind, how to rouse her nature so that she should expand from the child into the woman and make that response to him for which he sought. He was already well acquainted with her character, or thought he was, and he knew just how he meant to touch those secret springs that let loose the forces which lie latent in the natures of all of us, even the quietest. The old caretaker had prepared supper and Veronica had seated herself at table when he made his belated entry. The meal was quite a festive occasion. Lucas, absorbed in his new pursuit, was in an especially cheerful mood, and Veronica, who was fast losing her fear of him, was quite prepared to respond, with the result that Lucas, who was of the mercurial temperament, forgot all about his carefully laid plans and all he had ever known of psychology, and followed the way of a man with a maid, which, according to the wisest of mankind, can only be likened to the way of a serpent upon rock or a ship upon the sea. But to some extent it was she who was pulling the strings of his nature, not he of hers. It was the deep fountains of his being that were unsealed, while she, aloof as only those who are of virgin soul can be aloof, looked on, half frightened, half fascinated, at the forces she had roused, but, being a woman, thoroughly enjoying herself. He had always had a queer kind of fascination for her, and the fascination, in some curious way, was enhanced by the fact that she was afraid of him, so that, before the meal had ended, Veronica was drawn once again to smile upon Lucas. And the smile completed his undoing. It dawned slowly, like the smile of Mona Lisa, glowed for a moment with a revelation of all that could be in a woman, and then fled suddenly, as if alarmed at its own temerity. Lucas had set out to play a game, but he found himself caught in a current of the greater deeps. So does nature cheat those who seek to defraud her. Men have thrown away kingdoms for just such a smile, and Lucas threw away his soul. His only chance of safety in the present crisis lay in allegiance to his dark master, whose law is separateness. Only thus could he draw upon the force necessary to withstand the attack that was arrayed against him. Separateness might mean power, but it was in union that happiness lay, and union could only come through love, and now that Lucas had tasted love, he desired nothing else. The moon was up by the time the meal was finished, for meals go slowly under such circumstances. The clear cold radiance shone white upon the lawn save where the shadows of the shrubbery fell black as ink. The summer night in that shoot-in valley was almost as warm as the day, and they went out through the French windows onto the terrace. There, as they strolled up and down, Lucas slipped his hand through Veronica's arm, the long, olive-brown fingers in sharp contrast to the girl's white skin, and she, half child, half woman, was well content to let it rest there. So they strolled and turned, and strolled and turned, talking of life as each had seen it. She heard how Lucas had been born outside wedlock, the son of an opera singer and a man who stood high in political circles, how he had been brought up in the family of a small shopkeeper, and how the family circle had failed to contain him. A square peg had been driven into a round hole, but it was the hole that had split under the pressure. Then came the history of a rebellious, unmanageable lad, who jumped in and out of jobs as the hot southern temperament of his mother flared up within him, but presently the intellect of his father began to assert itself, and he struggled in night school to supplement the grammar school education that had been prematurely terminated by his eruption into freedom. At length he found himself as assistant to an old man who kept a second-hand shop. Into this abode of unhallowed dust came one day a curious article of commerce. It was a white, or rather Isabella-colored dust sheet some 3 yards square, upon which, by means of the liberal use of marking ink, a circle, 4 feet in diameter had been drawn. The interior of the circle was, save for dirty marks, left blank, but around its circumference was a most extraordinary collection of strange hieroglyphs and rude representations of creatures and things. The owner of the shop accepted the thing at its face value. A dust sheet was a dust sheet to him, and could be used for covering up the stock. The active-minded lad, however, was not so easily satisfied. Every time he unfurled a thing at night, he would puzzle over its hieroglyphs, and every time he bundled it up in the morning he would renew his quest. Then, one day when business was slack, he was looking through some of the books that lay about the shop, and in one of these books he found the clue to the mystery in a rough woodcut of which the dust sheet was evidently a copy. Wild with excitement, he learned that the mysterious sheet was a floorcloth used by a magician when he wished to invoke certain elemental presences. The operator stood in the center of the magic circle, and protected by the symbols that surrounded him, called upon the beings of another order of creation to take their stand each on his own sigil depicted upon the corners of the cloth. When closing time came, the young assistant locked the door from the inside, and spreading the magic dust sheet took his stand in the center of the circle and read aloud to the shadows the magical formula which the book declared to be suitable to the occasion. Then he waited. Absolutely nothing happened, and disgusted with the whole proceeding, himself included, he turned out the gas and went home, and so to bed. As he was dozing off to sleep, however, he was aroused to consciousness by the feeling that there was something in the room. He tried to reach out his hand to strike a light, but found himself powerless to move. He felt a breath in his face, a weight on his chest. Something was at his throat, and still he could not move. Then, with a supreme effort of will, he sat up, but found the room empty, even as the shop had been. Being a lad of sound nerves, he soon settled down and went to sleep again, and would have thought no more of his nightmare had it not been that in the morning, when he placed a reluctant foot upon the shabby oilcloth that paved his meager attic, he perceived that the floor was covered with slimy tracks as if an army of slugs had passed across it. The foul trail led from the window to the bed and back again, and when he examined it, he found that the window frame was covered with the filthy stuff. The creature that had left the trail had evidently entered by the 6-inch aperture left open at the top of the window for ventilation. For many nights after that the boy slept with his window shut, but the miscellaneous collection of books that had come, along with the floorcloth, from the house of some student of the occult arts, so inflamed his imagination that he could think of nothing else. His whole soul was gathered up into an appointed desire to learn the secret of the mystery to which he had been given a clue. What was it men sought by these mysterious means? How did they seek it, and who were the seekers? One evening, as he was spreading the magic dust sheet over the more precious of the rubbish, he saw a face peering at him through the window, and in a minute or two the owner of the face appeared in the doorway, and an individual of uncouth and hairy appearance demanded the price of the dust sheet. Lucas named a figure and without demur the stranger paid. Then he peered curiously at the lad. "Do you know anything about these things?" he inquired. Lucas, like most people in a hostile environment, was exceedingly reserved, but something about the stranger drew while it repulsed him, and before he knew what he was doing, he had embarked upon the story of his invocation and the subsequent slug tracks. The stranger fairly danced with glee, and almost without his consent, Lucas, the book, and the floorcloth were hailed round to the strangeress lodgings, there, huddled together inside the protecting circle, Lucas and the stranger read out the invocation in unison. So far as Lucas could see, nothing whatever happened, but the stranger, squinting horribly, announced that the powers invoked had duly appeared in their appointed places, and thereupon embarked upon an elaborate, arm-waving incantation, for it seems it was one thing to call them up, and quite another to get rid of them. However, after some minutes of droning and maneuvering, the stranger pronounced the room clear of the presences, and they sat down to a supper of sausages. That was the first of many suppers. Lucas never overcame his repulsion for the man, but his studies fascinated him, and he would return night after night to hear his host discourse of Paracelsus, Roger Bacon, Robert Flood, and the knowledge that had died with them. There was a miscellaneous collection of books in the frowsy lodgings, and the keen-minded lad soon had gathered the gist of them and drawn his own conclusions. A very little experimenting sufficed to show him that there was something tangible lying behind all the verbiage, but he also saw that the heart of the matter was not set down in the books. If he wanted knowledge, he would have to find someone who had that knowledge. As he was raking in the bins of a second-hand bookshop one evening, he fell into conversation with a man engaged in the same occupation. His new acquaintance was a very different type of man to the purchaser of the floorcloth. He was, in fact, none other than the old man with the white beard who always sat upon the chairman's left at the meetings of the council. Taking the measure of the shabby lad, he had decided that here was a mind of no ordinary caliber, and had taken him under his wing. Books were at the boy's disposal, and the stimulus of the conversation of a scholar had any stimulus been needed, and for the first time in his life, Lucas found himself in a congenial atmosphere. It was not long before initiation into the outer temple of the fraternity followed, and Lucas found that that which he had so long sought was his, for good or evil. Passed on from one introduction to another, Lucas made his way into Fleet Street and rose rapidly until his journalistic career was cut short by his appointment to the secretaryship of the fraternity. Then began the struggle between the idealism of the brethren and the fierce ambition of the man who was among them but not of them. Lucas told the story in vivid detail, never sparing himself, but using Veronica as a confessional for the relief of that which so long had been pent up within him without any means of expression. Before the story drew to its close, the moon had set, and darkness and dewfall drove them to take refuge in the house. Upon the step of the French window they paused, reluctant to leave the cool night for the close stuffiness of a lamplit room. Veronica lifted her hand. "Listen," she said, "foxhounds." "Nonsense, you silly child," said Lucas. "They don't hunt at this time of year, or at this time of night, either, for that matter." "But listen," cried the girl, "they are quite close, listen to the way they are baying. They have sighted their quarry." To her ears the bell-like notes of hounds hunting in view were coming nearer and nearer through the woods. Then she suddenly clutched her companion's arm. "Mr. Lucas," she cried, "they are not on the ground, they are overhead, in the air." She felt herself suddenly snatched through the window and the shutters slammed behind her. Lucas, ghastly faced, stared at her for a moment without speaking, and then dropped into a chair by the table and buried his face in his arms. Veronica, poor child, stared at him, helpless and distressed. The billing of the hounds that seemed to come from high overhead in the darkness sounded incredibly sinister, and the sight of the man bowed in distress over the table filled her with fear and foreboding even while it made her heart ache in sympathy for his uncomprehended trouble. She laid a timid hand on his shoulder. What is it? What is the matter? For answer, an arm reached out and encircled her and drew her to him, and he hid his face in the folds of her dress. For a long while they remained thus, the man rigid and motionless, the girl with her hand resting on his shoulder, every now and again stroking the rough tweed of his coat to convey the comfort she knew not how to express. Finally, he raised his face, curiously changed, and looked at her. Those were the astral hunting dogs, he said. The hounds of heaven. They hunt traitors with them. Who hunt traitors? Said Veronica. The brethren. And it was I who taught them to do it, too. And now they are hunting me. The new spirit in the fraternity. They did not like the new spirit in the fraternity, but they make use of it all right when it suits them. But they can be hunting you with dogs. No, they don't hunt with the dogs. They only use them to locate me. It is the ray they will use to kill me. Oh, but it is not possible, Mr. Lucas. It is all a bad dream. It is no dream, Veronica. They mean to kill me, and they are quite right. I am better dead, and if it were not for you, I should be glad to go, but I do not want to go now I have known you. He rose to his feet and faced her, the pupils of his eyes narrowed to pinpoints. His expression very evil, as she had not seen it for many days past. But I am not going, he said. Not very far, at any rate. He felt in his pocket and produced a penknife and opened it, and, before she realized what he was about, drove the blade into her arm. Don't be frightened, he said, as with a cry of mingled pain and terror she strove to escape from him. I won't hurt you. I am only doing this in order that I may be able to keep in touch with you when I get over on the other side. It is the blood link that savages use when they admit a stranger to the tribe, and it holds even through death. It is stronger than marriage. Then, holding her in a grip she could not resist, he raised the bleeding arm to his mouth and sucked the blood. She gazed at him in horror mingled with amazement. This was the old Lucas back again, the Lucas she had almost forgotten. He let go her arm, but retained his grip on her wrist so that she could not run away. Don't be angry with me, he said. I did not hurt you much, did I? Then he put both hands on her shoulders and looked straight into her eyes. Listen, Veronica, I may have to go. But I shall not go far. I shall come back again, keep a lookout for me. She still looked at him speechlessly, the old mute terror beginning to rise in her eyes. He drew her to him, and laid his cheek against hers. Be nice to me, Veronica. I may have to go soon. The tone of the man's voice, the ominous stillness of the silent house overcame Veronica, and she burst into tears and clung to him sobbing. For a while they stood thus, and then he gently released himself. That is midnight striking, I must go. The lodge sits at midnight. Kiss me good night, Veronica. Of her own free will she flung her arms round his neck and kissed him. Chapter 8. Veronica's sleep was troubled by dreams of foreboding. Through her dreams wandered the figure of Lucas, sometimes as the man she had known when she first went to live in the house in the Bloomsbury Square, and at other times he appeared as the man who had talked to her in the wood beside the river, opening up wide vistas of life that passed far beyond her horizon, and yet tempting her to go on and on as the white road tempts the traveller. But chiefly did he seem to her to be in some strange, unfathomable need that he could not explain, appealing to her for a help whose nature she could not divine. He would appear suddenly in the mazes of her dreams, holding out hands of entreaty, his eyes pools of blackness as they always were when the softer side of his nature was aroused. She would strive towards him, but he always eluded her, and she would toil across vast spaces, knowing him to be in trouble, knowing him to need her, and yet unable to find him. Out of this troubled sleep she would awake every hour, only to find the shadow of impending tragedy awaiting her upon the threshold of consciousness. Just before dawn, however, a change occurred. The shadow that had been vague, though portentous, suddenly gathered itself together into a definite shape. It condensed, narrowed, lengthened into the form of a great cross-handled sword. For a moment it drew back, as if to gain room for a blow,
Then it was thrust rapidly outward and downward with the force of some cosmic arm behind it. For a second it quivered, as if in the heart of a living creature, and then it was withdrawn, and Veronica, falling into a dead sleep, knew no more. She slept that heavy, dreamless sleep that leaves the body drugged by its own poisons, and would probably have slept till noon if she had not been aroused by the old caretaker shaking her violently by the arm. The horrified expression of the old woman's face told her that something had happened, though her toothless mumblings were unintelligible, but Veronica did not need to be told, she knew. Wrapping a kimono about her, she followed the old woman to Lucas's room. He lay upon the bed, stretched straight out, flat upon his back, feet together and arms crossed upon his breast, left over right, like a sculptured figure upon a tomb. The sunlight fell upon his face, and a drift of scarlet petals from the rambler that grew over the window had blown in and lay upon the white bedspread. The bedclothes were untossed, and the pillow bore the single hollow where the dark head rested. The room was utterly and completely still, and Veronica knew that she was alone in it. As quietly and deliberately as a man takes off his clothes, Lucas had withdrawn from his body during the night and passed into the realm of shadows that to him was the plane of reality. Whether he had awaited the thrust of the sword, or whether he had unlatched the door and stepped forth, she did not know. All she knew was that this was not death as she had been taught to conceive it. Lucas had gone, leaving his body behind. The olive-skinned body which had served them as a meeting place would be used no more. Whether he would communicate with her again was uncertain, but her friend had not ceased to be. She had no sense of grief or loss, but only of perplexity. How would Lucas manage to re-establish contact with her? Would he remember her, or would he forget? There was no sense of tumult in the room. With his departure the sounds of battle had died away, and now only the peace of emptiness brooded over the room. She seated herself in a chair beside the window, and sometimes she gazed out into the sunlit garden, and sometimes at the sunlit face upon the bed. Presently her solitude was again interrupted. A man stood in the doorway surveying the room, in his hand the little brown bag of his calling, a doctor whom the old woman had apparently summoned. He looked from the face on the pillow, stilled by the peace of death, to the face of the woman by the window, who seemed to share equally in the peace. Then he stepped over to the bed and commenced to make his examination without speaking. "I do not wish him touched," she said, speaking for the first time that day. The newcomer replied gently, "I am afraid he must be touched. There are many things we shall have to do, but you may be quite sure we shall do the very best we can for him, and for you, too. Tell me, are you any relation of his?"
"I am his secretary," said Veronica.
"Oh," said the doctor. "Well, anyway, we will do the best we can for you. But do you know where his relations may be found?"
"No," said Veronica. "I do not think he has any.
You have not been here many days, have you?
Where were you before you came here?"
Veronica told him.
"And what were you doing there?"
For one instant, Veronica was about to tell him, and then she knew that she could not. So she fell back upon bald statements of facts. She was in Lucas's employment. He had left his own employment and come down here, bringing her with him. She did not know why he had left his employment, she did not know who his employers were, some sort of a learned society, she thought. At any rate, if the doctor wrote to the Bloomsbury house they would probably give an account of themselves. It was no business of hers, she was well paid, and asked no questions. No, she was no relation of Mr. Lucas's. She had already told him so once. No, she did not know what his Christian name was. No, nor his age. He signed documents J. Lucas. No, she did not know what the J stood for. It might be James or it might be John. She had no idea. It was no business of hers. She had never troubled her head about it. She had always addressed him as Mr. Lucas. No, she could throw no light on the cause of his death. He had been quite well the night before. He had never complained of any illness, though he had spoken recently of feeling tired. The doctor grasped at this statement as the first tangible thing that had been offered him, and Veronica, as he did not ask, did not feel it incumbent upon her to inform him as to the cause of Lucas's exhaustion. Those who deal with the hidden side of things stand apart from their race, and they settle their differences among themselves by their own methods.